Okay, we continue our deliberations with an educational session on conceptual framework. I'll give the floor to Andrew.
Thank you, Hans. Good morning, everyone. The papers for this session are 10G, 10H and 10I. 10G provides a bit of background. 10H is a redraft of some of the key parts of the measurement chapter of the conceptual framework, and 10I is a slide deck to try to structure the discussion. So perhaps it would be most helpful if I just talk you very briefly through the slide deck that is in 10I. The exposure draft set out the proposition that there wouldn't be a single measurement basis, but that different bases would be used for different assets and liabilities, income and expenses. It categorised measurement bases as cost and current values, and it identified a couple of factors to consider. In fact, it identified more than a couple, but the contribution of the asset to future cash flows and the characteristics of the asset, i.e. its sensitivity to market and other risks and changes in cash flows, were the two that I think we probably will focus on. And I think these, I keep wanting to call them the main factors, but I'm told we don't actually use the description of main factors. But nonetheless, they are perhaps at the heart of it. Respondents to the exposure draft clearly indicated that the measurement chapter was one of the most challenging and one of the ones in which they were least satisfied, but they did like the description of the measurement bases. They liked the idea that there would be different measurement bases used for different assets and liabilities, and they liked the factors to consider. But they felt that the chapter as a whole failed to provide adequate guidance for the development of future accounting standards. On slide 5, I recall how the board has discussed those comments at their recent meetings and rejected the idea, which some respondents would have liked, of simply leaving a blank space for a measurement chapter and engaging in some form of fundamental research instead. The board agreed that we should continue to have a chapter on measurement, but that we should try to improve the discussion in the light of the responses, and in particular that those revisions should focus on the factors that I've already mentioned. Other tentative board decisions are recorded on slide 6 in summary form. We thought we probably could give some specific implications for the contribution of the asset and the characteristics of the asset, but that it would be unnecessary and possibly confusing to try to do so for faithful representation and the enhancing qualitative characteristics. We also decided that current costs should continue to be addressed in the framework, setting out its advantages and disadvantages, but that should be under the heading of current value rather than historical cost. And it's also been agreed that measurement uncertainty should be described as a factor affecting faithful representation rather than relevance. So moving on to slide 7, the objective of this educational session is to obtain your initial reactions to what we've done with the chapter, to see if it is an improvement and to see if it can be further improved. We say on the slides that we don't want drafting comments. That's always a difficult line to draw between what is drafting and what is substantive. And we're going to seek your views on the general approach, specifically focusing on the factors to consider. On slide 8, we mentioned that we're also going to be discussing this with ASAF at its meeting next week to get their reaction to the redraft, and they've got exactly the same draft as you have for this meeting. And the plan is that we'll revise the draft in the light of comments received both from the board today and from ASAF next week. And hopefully we can bring it back to you for a decision-making session in October. Let me just highlight a few points from the redraft. We've considered fairly carefully whether we could give a more structured approach, perhaps setting out some kind of flowchart or hierarchy or something, and we can't find a way of doing it that seems to work in all cases. So instead of that, we've rather reinforced the point that the the significance of particular factors will vary on circumstances, and different judgments may be made. I emphasise that here because sometimes we find in discussions that people sort of tend to pick out a particular paragraph in isolation and say that doesn't work in this case. Well, maybe it doesn't, but you've got to really consider all the factors together. We've given increased focus to relevance. That draws on the discussion of the quantitative characteristics that already appears in Chapter 2. And consistently with the exposure draft, that does tend to put the spotlight on these two factors of the contribution of the asset and its sensitivity to variability in cash flows. Turning to the first of those on slide 12, again building on what's been said already in the chapters of the framework where we hope not to make too many changes, it already says, well, some assets produce cash flows directly. Others are used in the business in combination with other assets and so generate cash flows indirectly. The redraft notes that this depends in part on the entity's business activities. That, I think, is broadly consistent with how it was described in the exposure draft, and it's intended as to achieve a compromise between those who think business activities are of fundamental importance and should virtually override everything else in the selection of a measurement basis, and between those who think that business activities should perhaps not even be mentioned in connection with measurement. For assets that will produce cash flows directly, the draft suggests that current values, such as fair value or value in use, are likely to be relevant. Where cash flows are produced indirectly, a cost-based measurement is likely to be relevant to the draft suggests. And of course, what's on the slide is very much a summary of what's in the full text on the paper. But we draw out, perhaps more emphatically, the fact that if you record your assets and liabilities at cost, then you can derive information on margins at the time that you actually sell the asset or whatever. We thought that we should perhaps supplement that with some specific cases, and those are summarised on slide 14. Debt liabilities are unlikely to be transferred, and so they might be measured at cost. Financial assets held to contract contractual cash flows, cost-based information may be relevant. Again, it gives information on margins. Inventory has always been a particularly tricky one in the sense that if you say something you're going to sell should be at current value, then, well, what assets are you going to sell? The prime example is inventory. So we've tried to explain why inventory that's held in a sort of value-adding type business would be considered to be held in conjunction in a business activities for use in conjunction with other assets, notably that were required to undertake selling activities, and so cost-based information may be relevant. And we contrast that with commodity-type inventory, which actually mirrors the requirements of IAS 2, which applies only to, which excludes from its scope commodity-type inventory held by brokers and dealers. And consistent with IFRS 15, we know that cost-based information may be relevant for performance obligations. On the characteristics of the asset and liability, we say that where cash flows or value is likely to be variable or sensitive to market risks, a current value is likely to be variable. We note that amortized cost cannot be used where the cash flows are variable and do not represent simply the connection of principal and interest. And we say that where the value is sensitive, current value seems to be relevant to some of the features that have been identified in Chapter 1 as being of interest to users of financial statements. Perhaps controversially, one of the things we say there is that current values are helpful for assessing stewardship. I think some might disagree and think historical cost was more relevant. And we also note that historical cost, where assets are, where the value of an asset is highly variable, might not produce appropriate income and expenses, because it will be recognised when the asset is disposed of or the liability settled. So with that rather lengthy introduction, I'll turn it over and look forward to your views. The questions on slide 16 are the same as those in paper 10G. I don't know if we'll be able to go through them sequentially or whether we'll go around a bit.
Thank you. Andrew, let me try to test this long introduction with two very basic type of assets. One is a loan, plain vanilla, by a bank, which normally keeps it to maturity and collects cash flows. The other asset is a license of intellectual property, which is on a standalone basis, produces cash flows because you collect 5% return on sales by your licenses. And this is kept by an industrial company, which is just managing it on a standalone basis. These two types of assets produce cash flows directly. Both are capable of being sold, capable. They might be sold, but it's not the business model. So if I apply paragraph 6.54b, what we say here, we would say is that the most relevant measurement is likely to be fair value. But then we make an exception in 6.54e for financial assets, because the nature is financial assets. Then we say, in that case, cost-based measurement is likely to be more relevant. But at the beginning, those two assets have the same characteristic. Of course, they are of a different nature. One is intangible, the other one is financial. But why is it that we would conclude that normally, or whatever the way we draft it, we would have different measurement basis for the two kinds of assets? I'm not sure whether the assertion that we make here in 654B, and of course it depends how you interpret likely in this sentence, but I'm not sure we are not putting too much emphasis on the fair value measurement just because the asset is capable of being sold. I think, is it the nature of the asset, or is it the business model of the entity which prevails here? And I know it's the old question, always coming back and back and back to us. But in contrast to financial assets, I'm not sure whether I see the logics of coming to two different conclusions for measurement.
I just wonder if perhaps, just thinking on my feet as it were, obviously, the problem is that 6.54e is drafted too narrowly and that it focuses only on financial assets and liabilities. And it might be worth considering whether it should be expanded to refer to all assets and liabilities that have fixed contractual cash flows. That might be something that we might think about.
Greg Wall.
Basically, I think if you simply look at slides, I think we generally accept all the conclusions. You know. And my basic question is related to some extent the Philippe's question, that is, under what conditions we should have two-step test. You know, for financial instruments, you know, nine already clearly, you know, set principles based on two-step, you know, type of doctrine. And therefore, you know, if you purely look at, you know, page 14, and 14, the second bullet point, where financial assets held to collect to cash flow, and if you, you know, conclude in isolation, and then will amortize cost. But now I clearly say that you have another test, you know, variability of the asset. The reason why I ask this is, you know, it's quite important. For example, inventory, you know, I don't think anyone would say it should be fair valued. But there, if you look at the possible, the sale, and the price may change, you know, also. Yep. And then how, you know, under such conditions, we say basically you look at, you know, the one side rather than two-step test. Yep. And similarly, PPE, you know, and basically people will not say it should be fair valued unless you choose revalued model. But you know, the like taxi company, the cars, the value will change so dramatically, and that whether we need a second test. And the last one is, if you look at the page 14, last bullet point, I will feel insurance should be cost-based. If you look at our current wordings of the new standards, I will feel more close to, you know, performance obligation type of the logic. But we decide to use current value. It's mainly because the availability of the future cash flows, interest rate, and others. So my basic question is, you know, how and what kind of condition we say you should use two tests or one test only?
Well, I think that the response in the redraft is the paragraph that says the importance of various factors will depend on the facts and circumstances. Therefore, you shouldn't consider, perhaps it's going too far to say you should never consider any one factor in isolation. I think we do have wording that says, in most cases, one factor on its own will not be decisive. So I think there is the flexibility there to... I would say that what we've got actually does two things. One of the things, it tells you what to think about. But secondly, it's flexible enough that you could come to consistent conclusions.
I think the problem is whether or not we use words that take you to one direction, or whether we first say depends, and then say, based on that, you may go that direction or not. But here we seem to say first, likely to be more relevant when, and of course,
I think the wording was very careful and flexible. I think it's a big improvement. And in most cases, leads more or less to the right answer. I mean, going back and forth between being very prescriptive and less prescriptive, you have to end somewhere. Mary,
I've got a whole range of points across the questions that you have on the last slide, Andrew. I mean, in overall, in terms of direction, I think it's heading the right way. When you think about things like having the two factors, not having a rigid hierarchy, you know, as you said, I think we've got to, I feel heading in the right direction, but I think it needs to shrink. and the reason I say that, and I'm not going to give specifics now because that's more drafting, but I think it comes across at times how to do this measure versus what is this measure and what information does it provide. And I think that kind of just distracts from the message about how do you select, giving a relatively brief description of the key characteristics of each measure, and then focusing on how do we select from them. And and for that reason, I'd hesitate to put in as many examples as you've suggested, because it does become more like starts to feel like a quasi-standard, or the compilation of the basic principles in a number of existing standards. So I think I would challenge each of the examples generally. Overall, in some
but
other...
Mary, if we go back again to very broad strokes, people will start nitpicking it immediately.
I think it is
what
somewhere...
We did. This is going back a little bit first, back to the first draft, which was accused of being just whitewashing all...
Right. But if you...
I think they found a pretty happy medium here.
I think it's the happy medium plus 120%, it's 120% of a happy medium. Just that it's scale, but I think some of the more detailed points, both about the description of the basis, you know, what's in and what's out, and how you calculate income and expense, as examples, feels like a bit too much detail. And I think that additional words don't respond to the comments for additional insights into how choices are made. And so when we respond to that, I think it's more specificity rather than more, you know, more guidance in this situation and that situation. And I think we have to worry about trying to throw every possible argument mm-hmm. in response to a criticism, that came back on the exposure drafter and some of the subsequent discussions with ASAP, because I think there are a few things, and I'll use this as an example. In inventory, the idea that it's the difficulty of finding a customer, that I think we need to look at that section again and whether that's the right argument. And just because it's a possible argument for why doesn't mean to me that we should put it in the conceptual framework itself. And to me, I think it's maybe more about, I think you're right to focus on the selling effort involved, but I think it raises questions about whether it's a faithful representation rather than relevance to reflect inventory at current value, at a current value of some kind, if that portrays it as if there were basically no selling effort involved. And I think we can bring it out, but I think the specific, and I'm just using that as an example of where we think we're trying to throw in every argument that we come up with, as opposed to saying be relatively brief and focus on something. The a section that I, one thing that I think is missing, if I look at 6.54, the base paragraph, I'm not sure that we explain why we think, how it contributes, and the characteristics of the asset and liability, the two-prong test, are the reason we go through it. We jump into a lot of immediate detail, but I think some of it comes back to just saying explicitly the basic point about we think considering these two factors together are the best way to give information that's useful to users in terms of, among other things, predicting the future cash flows that will be, generated by the items, and that's why we are focused on these two points. I think it's instinctive to see how it contributes to cash flows as relating to giving the most useful information, but I think we should spell it out, and then the subsequent sections build it out. Then one or two other things, and I think I struggled a bit, and I'd maybe flag it up for for Sue and her FI section. The absolute nature of some of the comments about amortized cost, I'm not sure that it cannot, that cost account cost accounting could not be applied when there's variability. First of all, I think it would be confusing if you were thinking of a variable rate instrument and reading that. I think rather if you're having to reset the cash flows, it's that the reset of the amortized cost calculation would be very frequent and very complex. And I think I would question the cost benefit value of that information rather than saying it is impossible to do this. I think impossible is too strong a comment. And then the last thing, and this is where I come to a question for you, I spent a lot of time scratching my head around the income and expense comments related to liabilities, because there was an implication that every settlement of a liability involved income, but not necessarily expense. And that makes sense when the liability I'm thinking about is a performance obligation, but it doesn't make sense to me about if I have a liability for financing.
Yeah.
Especially because the expense section doesn't talk about the notional, about there being a notional expense for the outflow for the principal of debt settlement. I don't think it should, but if there isn't expense in the debt settlement, then why is it always discussed as the income resulting from satisfaction of liability? And I think that's the section that I felt most didn't hang together, and it comes up in several pieces, you know, in the table, in the analysis of the characteristics, in talking about both relevance and faithful representation. So that's the piece that I'd say, apart from drafting and, you know, sizing and thinking about whether we need every example, I'd ask the staff to go back and think about a bit more on this one.
Thanks, Mary. One of your comments that I wanted to just mention is certainly we should look at what we say about amortized cost and the very strong statement there. But as I recall, I was encouraged to be that bold by referring to the basic conclusions on IFRS 9. So, yeah. But yeah, that's not to say it shouldn't be. I'm not disagreeing with reconsidering.
Let's think about it, and I mean, reminding ourselves of the reasoning we used as recently as IFRS 9 is important. But to me, what we write in the conceptual framework should be looking ahead and drawing on our experience and setting the standards, but not constrained by it.
Stephen? I agree with a lot of what Mary's just said. I also have lots of comments, some of which I've given you before. But my overall take on this is that it's too long, and it's straying into sort of on-the-fly standard setting in some places. So, for example, there's a bit about the risk adjustment on liabilities and the whole debate we had in IAS 37. There's a throwaway comment about users may not find that useful when you get the reversal in the P&L. And that's kind of summarizing in a few sentences a very long and tortuous debate that we had, which I think is more appropriate at a standards level. And then there was the bit about the splitting of a fair value change, and you give an example. That again seems to me to be standards level type discussion. I mean, and you know, don't get me wrong, I think that there's a lot of good stuff in here, but I wouldn't want it to be seen as providing us that standards level guidance. We want something high level, we want it principles based, we want it to guide the board, but not provide us with the answers. Yep. So another one is own debt issued. There's a pretty strong conclusion here that cost is the best measurement basis for that, which I disagree with. I think fair value of own debt is really important. Maybe not in the primary financial statements, maybe in the notes which we currently have, but I could read this as almost saying that the IFRS 9 requirement to disclose the fair value of own debt was the wrong conclusion, which I think it definitely isn't, and we really don't want to remove that piece of information. 6.32, I'm concerned about this reference to observed in an active market. I read that whole paragraph as implying that level 2 and level 3 fair values shouldn't really be used. And I don't like the use of the word verifiable here. I'm not even sure that it's consistent with the definition of verifiable that we have in the framework itself. So I'm concerned about that. Unlike Philippe, perhaps I'm concerned that 6.30 is too restrictive on fair value. And that together with, what was the other paragraph, 2.54 something, was implying that fair value is only useful if you're going to sell the asset or transfer the liability. And I think it's going too far in that direction. And it links in with my point about IFRS 9 and fair value of own debt. If you imply that fair value is only relevant when you transfer debt, well, you're never going to have fair value information for own liabilities issued because most of them aren't transferred. So I think it's still too weighted against fair value in these situations. So I like the you know, the basic principles of selecting measurement base is fine, but it's all the detail that goes with it, some of which I disagree with, but I just find it sort of going into the standard setting area.
Chang Wu.
Thank you. Thank you for the good analysis and good writing here. This is a difficult issue. And so I just would like to suggest some maybe improvements if it's possible. I agree with Dr. Phillips and Vagos, Mary's. How about adding some paragraph? If there is some kind of a conflict engaged between this contribution model and their characteristics model. The reason why I'm saying is in IFRS 9, we limited the application of historical cost or amortized cost method in the case of the business activity model and the characteristics and something. So in that case, others, we have to apply fair value. So what I'm saying, that vague sense of this 2x2 matrix, so we'll better give us some kind of a conceptual principle on that issue. Another thing is, another thing that I'd like to suggest is how about adding some examples or analysis under the heading of faithful representation, like you've done under the heading of relevance. You provide all kinds of examples. Many people still think historical cost is good in terms of faithful representation rather than relevance. So this is another good part to support why historical cost is still good in a measurement basis. So that's another thing is, one final thing is, just maybe editorial, you asked me any comment from us, so maybe the position of current cost discussion, mm-hmm. I guess, why don't you put that discussion at the end of current value discussion, because current cost measurement base is not so popular, common in our current existing standards, rather you're putting on that discussion on the top of the current value, you better put the other side. Thank you.
Thanks.
Tuck?
Thank you. Just clarification. So there was a talk in the ED about the more than one relevant measurement basis, which starts from 6.74 to 6.78, and we are not discussing it today. Is there any plan to discuss it separately?
Yes, we do in mind to bring that back to the board with our suggestions for how to take it forward. That's very much part of our thinking.
All right. So in that case, may I understand in this way? So that the part we are discussing at the moment is that only the situation when one measurement basis is appropriate.
I think it would apply generally. I mean, presumably the implication of the more than one measurement basis section, however, is that one might reach a different conclusion when thinking about income and expenses than when thinking about assets and liabilities. But yes, both of those views would presumably be informed by these factors.
Thank you. Actually, this is relating to the question casted by Changu. So there is a case that there is some conflict between two measurement bases, and sometimes one solution is to put it difference into OCI, and we have to seek for what is the relevant timing for recycling OCI. So those are the quite important issue to know what the performance is all about, because we are saying profit or loss is a major source of communication. Therefore, I think this is fine up until we discuss the cases where more than one measurement basis are relevant. But when it comes to the situation, more than one measurement case are relevant, then we need to come back and discuss what is a proper Okay. The other thing is one simple drafting suggestion or question. 654K. 654K says that historical cost, if historical cost is used, change in value would not be reported when the value of the asset or liability changes, but only when it is disposed of. I agree with it, but how do you evaluate the case of impairment and depreciation? Would completely neglect, or do you think you should include it?
I think the paragraph is not well drafted. I think you put your finger on it. It's not all, some changes in value are done to historical cost. The point that should be made there is changes in value due to price changes are generally not recognised under historical cost. So thanks for that.
Okay, thank you. Martin?
Yeah, I think it was a good effort and demonstrate for me at least, I think that the objective what you want to do is really to provide more guidance when the board should use which measurement basis is not possible in the conceptual framework, because we have seen that you try to base it on cash flows of the instruments, on business models, but then we have exceptions to that, and based on what type of asset it is, and which I would conclude, okay, we have tried it, because there was a criticism, okay, that this what we had in the ED doesn't provide too much guidance, and we tried it now with cash flows, with characteristics, but then we can only do it with kind of exceptions, but that would lead to, I think, too much detailed in the conceptual framework. And I think really we should go back to what can be kind of factors, but not really then trying in the conceptual framework to give more guidance in which situation we should try, we should use which measurement basis. I think it was a good try, but for me at least it demonstrates that it is not possible. And at least not possible in the concept of a conceptual framework, because when we have then to write pages and pages and pages of situations which could occur when that measurement maybe as a principle would then not be the right one, and therefore I think we should go back to what we had done in the ED. That is my conclusion from that.
Well,
back to inventory. You know, the principles here basically say if they involve significant or lots of saving effort, you know, then you know the cost. Otherwise, you know, the fair value. But think about a manufacturing company, sign a contract, 100% sell to Walmart. There's no saving effort at all. And there is a market price, should be cost or fair value.
If you're looking for a response, we.
I really dislike this kind of discussion. You know, come up with fantastic examples.
We try to improve.
And this is the problem that we've continually faced with this chapter. Is that we tried in the discussion paper we ended up with something that was quite detailed and got criticised for it was going into too much standards level detail, and tried to cover a lot of these examples that people keep coming up. In the exposure draft we pulled right back and we've got criticised for the fact that actually it doesn't go into enough detail and it doesn't provide enough guidance. With Andrew's redraft here we're trying to sort of provide a compromise between what we had in the discussion paper and what we had in the exposure draft, where we're going into more detail, but again we're hearing from the board sort of conflicting views as to what we should do with that. We're hearing from some board members that actually we should pull back and we should reduce it, that we've gone too far, and we're hearing from other board members, oh, but what about this example, what about this example, and it's proving quite difficult from a staff perspective to know what to do going forward. So any help, please?
I really think, you know, we have to decide to either go back to the original of the ED, where we basically say we don't have any conceptual basis for our measurement decisions in the past.
We just
do it on the fly, or we try to do something.
I don't remember saying the words "we do it on the fly" in the.
Well, it could very well be the case. So, Mary, be helpful. What should he do?
About 60% of what he did, but there's a lot of, I think we should be focusing less on examples and more on, have we got a complete discussion of the benefits and the weaknesses that each of the measurement bases provides? So those are the things that are spelled out rather than how you do it. You include this, you deduct that, you do it, you know, and less of saying, therefore, this means we reach X conclusion. I'm not saying take out every example, but I think we should be far more sparing. So that's overall what I think we should be doing. I put my flag up a big again because it struck me that three other things that I just wanted to mention as directional thoughts about this. One is that we should find a way to make this clear that these are factors that are considered in setting the requirements in a standard. Because I think if we get so focused on writing all of these things and we don't make that context clear, it almost suggests to people that this, when you're preparing your financial statements, here are the factors you have to weigh when you're setting accounting policies. And I think we should be clear that these are the factors that are weighed when setting the requirements at a standards level. I think it was helpful to have spelled out, and I think this is one of the additions that we should keep, the kind of information that each measurement base would provide and when it might be useful. But one of the things that struck me as I was looking at the historical cost section is that in its focus on margins and having some predictive value, we didn't have to me enough about when that predictive value wouldn't be there. So for example, if it's a very long-lived asset, then the margins that you have for something that costs, that you bought 25 years ago, might not have predictive value for what it would cost to replace that and maintain the capacity. To me, that doesn't knock out historical cost, but it just it makes a point that kind of that's almost a counterbalance to the point of, if you're going to use something for 25 years, why bother revaluing it if you're planning to use it for for that period of time? It doesn't give an answer one way or another, but I think that that's pervasively a consideration that's missing of when will some of the features that we identify not be delivered? What are things that may be counter indicators? And the last is the third point that I had was that I think one of the benefits of the table and doing kind of the more rigorous comparison, this is in, transaction costs in, transaction costs out, raised a question for me that I don't think we have focused on, and this is something I think you should bring back to us, not as a draft of a section, but have we reached a clear decision, and that's for fulfillment value. Do we conclude that conceptually fulfillment value always includes in the measurement the uncertainty of the different outcomes and compensation for bearing that uncertainty?
Yeah.
If so, I think that highlights more stresses with some of the existing standards on liability. We have that when a liability arises from maybe revenue or insurance, where it's providing a service. But I think very few people think about provisions in IS 37 that way. Yep. Doesn't mean we should go there. One of the things I'd ask the staff bring back, and I think it comes out of the discipline of putting that table together to say, here are the things that are included. Is it the same asset and liability?
Yep.
And it just flushed out that we've not, to my mind, had an on-point discussion of fulfillment value and all the factors that go into value and use.
Yep. Gary?
Yet, on balance, I actually like what's here, and I think it's an improvement from where we were. I'm inclined to think, if anything, it's probably slightly too long, and I suspect if I had the whole conceptual framework draft in front of me, this is probably the longest chapter. What I would do, though, assuming it's going to stay roughly this length, I would probably reduce the front part, you know, the descriptions of the different values, and spend more time on the back part about factors to consider. Because I think, you know, what is fair value is probably reasonably understood. What is historical cost is probably reasonably understood. The question is, when do you use one versus the other? And then even inside it, which variant of one versus the other I think would be more useful about, as opposed to an elongated description of them. But when we get into the descriptions and then the front half of the document, what I think is missing in here, and it's probably more of a build as opposed to missing, is we don't really have much of a discussion of when to use entry versus exit prices, and appreciate fair value has long been articulated as a market participant point of view, but sometimes you end up drifting into an entity-specific point of view and so on, and does it always reflect only a market participant point of view, and if so, which market participant?
Yeah.
And you might want to articulate why is not the reporting entity who's in the market not a market participant. And I know in IFRS 13, other standards, this has been gone through before, but I would find it's sort of conspicuous that very little of that is in here. Like I said, I would still tone down the front and perhaps add more to the back.
I'm not so sure I agree with Gary that the front part should be reduced, because I think this, it is written in an economic fashion, and it does clearly portray all the advantages and disadvantages of the different measurement bases.
Well, I think it's well written. I mean, that's the question is it just longer than it needs to be? And maybe it's the examples or the stuff approaching standards, although it just comes across as a little bit too long.
I think most of the comments were to economize a little bit more on the examples in the letter text, and I think I thought the beginning was very good. It also helps dispelling some of the myths of the different around the different measurement categories. Sue?
I also agree it's in the right direction. I think perhaps if we were to beef up a little bit the why the business activities and contractual or the cash flow characteristics matter, along the lines of what Mary was saying in her first set of comments, and beef up why that matters, maybe we can take away some of the examples at the end, because it would be more obvious why you'd get to those conclusions. But I'll come to you offline with a few suggestions of where I think we can reduce the specifics. But I think the overall approach is along the right line. So I'll come with some specific suggestions of where I think we could delete a few things. I stumbled on the same point as Mary in terms of the satisfaction of liabilities point. I was doing debits and credits in the margin and thinking, not getting anything going to P&L. But that's just a detail point. So I think that the general approach you've got here is good. I'll come with a few specific drafting and suggestions and edit suggestions.
Stephen?
I agree that having more focus on what we mean by contribution to future cash flows and why that's important, and if that leads to a cost-based measurement, how cost-based measurements can still have predictive value through the margins and the like would be a good way of doing it. I've got a couple more specific comments. If I may. 6.58A talks about the level of measurement uncertainty, but then right at the bottom of page 13 it links it to relevance, which I thought seems a bit odd given our past decision.
Great. I should have been more thoroughgoing in the consequential changes when I moved it from relevance to representation. I completely agree with that point.
6.35, talk about value in use and fulfillment value may sometimes be customized, and then we talk about using market participant assumptions about the time value of money. And that this is what's always confused me about value in use, because I don't know how you do value in use without a market participant a market discount rate. Because I don't understand how you get to a discount rate without looking at the market. So it seems very odd to say sometimes and then have this as an example. I know you want to make value in use entirely entity specific, but I just physically don't see how you can ever make it.
Well, haven't we seen in practice that companies can be extremely creative with finding discount rates?
But we always anchor it in the market. And okay, there's judgment involved in selecting a discount rate, as with many other things where you cannot observe directly the market rate, like with our insurance and the illicit risk rate, there's judgment involved. But we're not saying pick an entity specific discount rate, which is kind of what this implies. The current cost aspect of it, I agree with Changwu that I prefer to put it, in fact I'd like to delete it altogether, but let's put it at the end at the least, because we don't use current cost. So it seems odd that that should be the first one that we discuss within the current value section. And then lastly, 6.24 and 6.23. So 6.24, we say the fair value of an asset is the same as the fair value of a liability of the counterparty, which is true because it's in IFRS 13. But then in the previous paragraph, we say that the risk premium or risk discount, so assets are reduced by risk and liabilities are increased by risk, but surely that's a contradiction then of 6.24, because how can you physically have the liability equal to the asset when the asset is reduced for risk and the liability is increased for risk?
Okay. Well, so I think the majority of the board at least like the direction in which this is going. There have been a lot of specific comments, many of which Andrew has acknowledged. And then there has been the more general comment about trying to leave out all these examples. But I still think that we retain the ambition to doing more than what we did in the ED.
Okay.
Do you have enough to go on, Andrew? Because we are sending in all sorts of directions.
No, I think this has been a very helpful discussion. I mean, I think as Rachel highlighted, not all the comments necessarily point me in the same way, which I'll have to try to work my way through, but I'm grateful to the board for those comments, which, as I say, I think are very constructive, and I'm glad that, as Hans says, there seems to be general support for this kind of direction.
Okay, I will leave it up to the outside world to come up with all sorts of smart examples that don't fit into your diagram.